Hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open and calling to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the second day of our panel. Judge Newsom, Judge Choflat, and I are happy to have you all here. Unfortunately, by Zoom, we were supposed to be in Jacksonville this week, but hopefully that will change soon and we'll be able to get back to our normal business the way we typically handle it. You have a clock on the corner of the monitor, so that'll tell you where your time is. You'll also get a 2-minute warning from Valerie when your time is about to run. If we take you beyond your time, then don't worry about it. You're on our time and not yours. We had a little bit of a technological problem yesterday, specifically a problem on my end of things, and I lost connection. So if that happens to me or to anyone else today, just hold on, and we will try to get that person back on as quickly as possible. So bear with us if we have any issues. We're all trying to get by as well as we can. And with that, we're ready for our first case. It is numbers 19-13366 and 19-13587, United States versus Edwards et al. And we will start with Mr. Labonte. Good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Adam Labonte on behalf of Nolan Edwards. The issue in this case is whether Section 404 of the First Step Act authorizes a district court to impose a component of a sentence that was not imposed at the original sentencing. Under Section 404, a district court can reduce only what was previously imposed at as if the Fair Sentencing Act was in effect. A court may only reduce, not increase, the previously imposed sentence. The court cannot add.
Can I ask you, Mr. Labonte, this is Judge Newsom. Can you
yes.
explain to me why it is, in just sort of real world terms, why this isn't a reduced sentence from life without release to most anything, it seems to me, would be reduced.
Right. So a sentence is composed of several different parts, and those parts include a term of imprisonment, a term of supervised release, and a fine. So, for example, if a defendant was sentenced to life in prison and the court said, well, because you're going to prison for life, I'm not going to impose a fine. And then if it was reducing the sentence, it were to impose or increase the fine that was previously imposed, that would not be consistent with what the Section 404 authorizes. When a sentence is imposed, it's considered a final sentence. So to impose a reduced sentence as if, one can only reduce what already existed.
Well, I guess, but you want to break a unitary sentence up into components. You keep saying that you can't add a component, but 404 just says reduced sentence. And I mean, are you telling me that your clients would rather have life without release than the sentence they have? I mean, isn't the fact that they would prefer this sentence pretty good evidence that it is in fact a reduction?
The term of imprisonment is a reduction, but I submit that any component that wasn't in existence when the sentence was imposed and is otherwise final is an increase or an addition to the sentence that was previously imposed.
And just one more question, and then I'll shut up. So what's the authority, though, for breaking out the sentence into components? You keep talking about components, but 404 just says sentence.
Well, I think you have to look at the original sentencing hearing. And an original sentencing is when a court has to consider everything in its totality and decide what the sentence to be imposed is. And so at the original sentencing hearing, a court has the authority to impose a term of imprisonment, a term of supervised release, a fine after consideration of all the factors. So in this case, I think in imposing a reduced sentence, we are stuck with, the Section 404 is a limited remedy. So we are dealing with the sentence as exists at the time it's being reduced. And here, the only component of a sentence that was imposed as to Mr. Edwards was a term of imprisonment. So by converting to or adding or increasing a term of supervised release does not comport with the language of Section 404. And a good example of, and the court has asked whether the appropriate vehicle here is Section 404, 3582 C1B. And I submit that no matter what the vehicle is, the district court was without authority. If we look at section 3582C1B, which says that the court may modify a previously imposed sentence consistent with the statute, and then we look to the neighboring provision for compassionate release, 3582C1A, there Congress explicitly allows a district court to convert the remaining term of imprisonment to a term of probation or supervised release with or without conditions that previously existed. And under section 3582C1B or in section 404, Congress did not afford district courts that authority. So I think in imposing a reduced sentence, the court can reduce what was previously imposed, and to do so otherwise equates to a plenary resentencing hearing.
Well, let me ask you this hypothetical. So let's say that the district court at the original sentencing had made a mistake, and instead of imposing, I guess back then it was a 10-year term of supervised release, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so the district court made a mistake and imposed a 2-year term of supervised release, but nobody really cared because in practical terms, as Judge Newsom hinted, the defendant was serving a life sentence, so the supervised release term would theoretically never kick in. If the district judge imposed a 2-year term of supervised release, could he now impose a term of supervised release?
I submit if he increased the term of supervised release, that would not be consistent with what 404 allows the court to do. It could leave that component intact, but to say, for example, the statutory range called for a 10-year term, and under section 404 and applying the Fair Sentencing Act, it was now an 8-year term. I submit the court couldn't increase the 2-year term of supervised release to 8 years because section 404 only provides the authority to impose a reduced sentence.
But it also says, you're right about the reduced sentence language, but it also says, as if sections 2 and 3 of the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010 were in effect at the time the covered offense was committed. And so if you look at that clause along with the reduced sentence clause, doesn't it force the district judge to put himself or herself back in time and just impose, as Judge Newsom hinted, a unitary new sentence that complies with the Fair Sentencing Act?
If the court is to read it that way, I think that amounts to a plenary resentencing. And this court in the Denson case says that a proceeding under section 404 is a limited remedy, and the court is not called upon to answer questions that didn't consider at the original sentencing.
Well, but that may lead to the second question, which is, although we've said that you generally aren't entitled to a resentencing hearing in these types of cases, you may be entitled to some sort of process if the district judge is going to impose a term of supervised release and has to figure out, for example, what conditions to impose. If the judge is going to impose conditions, for example, beyond the standard ones, it seems to me that both the defendant and the government should be heard on that issue, because that's a discretionary matter for the district court, and it may or may not be proper to impose non-standard conditions of supervised release. Is that a separate question, or is it linked up with everything else you're arguing?
Well, I think that it's a secondary question here. So the first question the court has to answer is, what does section 404 allow the district court to do? And Mr. Edwards submits that it allows the court to reduce what previously existed. To do otherwise undermines the purpose of the initial sentencing if the court is going to reconsider things. Here, the court, and I recognize that it's the court erred. I just submit that section 404 is not the appropriate channel for the court to correct the error. The other avenues for which the court could have corrected this mistake would have been on a remand on a direct appeal, but this issue was not addressed there. Mr. Edwards filed a 2255 motion. This was not addressed there. Under Rule 35, as it exists now, says that correction of an error is limited to 14 days after entry of the judgment, and we're well beyond that time period. So I submit that section 404, as the court said in Denson, being a limited proceeding, and the court not being called to answer questions it didn't consider at the original sentencing precludes the court from adding this component to the sentence.
Suppose the judge in imposing the sentence had imposed a 10-year term of supervised release. What message would that send to the defendant?
That is the common practice, and I submit that what happened.
He's got a sentence of life without parole. So what message would be sent to the defendant if the court tacked on a 10-year supervised release?
Well, I think it recognizes that the laws, as we see with Section 404 and the Fair Sentencing Act, do change it sometimes in a defendant.
Wouldn't it tell the defendant that without parole is meaningless?
Well, I think the example here in Mr. Edwards' case is shows that why
it's a warning, counsel.
Thank you. I think that Mr. Edwards' case shows why it's important that the court at the original sentencing follow the mandates of the statute, which says a life sentence still requires a 10-year term of supervised release. And with the enactment of Section 404, making the Fair Sentencing Act retroactive, the penalties have changed. And I think that it puts Mr. Edwards in a different spot. I think that there's an assumption when a sentence is imposed that it is final, but as we see here, that is, you know, not for certain.
The reason I ask that question is it would send the message to the defendant that without parole is meaningless. So he has some hope that he's got a life sentence without parole, but that's meaningless because there's going to come a time when the court is going to put him on release him. He'll be released and put on supervised release.
And Your Honor,
that's in the category of breeding disrespect for the rule of law or misleading people. That's what I'm driving at.
But unfortunately, you know, no matter whether it's disrespect for the law, Congress has mandated that the court, even in imposing a mandatory life sentence, still should impose or must impose a 10-year term of supervised release,
even though it's meaningless.
Right. But for example, here in Mr. Edwards' case, that imposition would ultimately not be meaningless because Mr. Edwards was later eligible for a reduced sentence.
Let me ask you this policy question. And I know policy is far from what we're supposed to be deciding, but if we hold, as you ask us to hold, that a district court in this situation cannot impose a term of supervised release, right? Now, remember, the Fair Sentencing Act applies and the First Step Act apply to a lot of cases that don't involve life sentences, but involve severe sentences, for example, for crack cocaine offenses. If we say and hold that you cannot impose a term of supervised release in these circumstances, does that create the perverse effect or incentive for a district judge to say, I'm not reducing your sentence because I can't make sure that you're going to be on supervised release afterwards, and I don't want to take that chance, and so I'm going to use my discretion and deny your motion for a reduction of sentence?
And Your Honor, I see I'm over time, so I can answer your question, correct?
Yes, please.
I would submit that this is a very rare situation where an issue like this has arisen. Generally, even in imposing life sentences, from what I've seen and working on several hundred of these First Step Act cases over the last 2 years, is that in imposing a life sentence, the court imposes the term of supervised release required by statute. Here, the district judge did not condition the reduction on whether he could impose a term of supervised release or not. And that is the sole issue on appeal here.
I know, but I'm asking you what happens down the road with a different judge who is faced with the same scenario, a judge who made a mistake in terms of what supervised release term he or she imposed the first time around.
I mean, that could be a consideration of the judge, but I think, you know, in a case where the defendant and the judge can look at their prison record and if in their discretion they want to reduce the sentence, that is totally within the court's discretion to do so.
Because of Title 18, Section 3553, the court takes all the sentencing purposes into account. Is that right?
Correct.
So your answer to Judge Jordan's question is that the court, in taking all those things into account, can say, I'm not going to reduce the sentence.
A court would be...
It remains a life sentence.
The court has made clear that a motion brought under Section 404 is within the court's discretion whether to reduce it or not. And I think a court, in consideration of all the 3553A factors, can make whatever determination it is. And I reiterate that, you know, the situation in Mr. Edwards' case is quite rare. It's only come up in a handful of cases here, most of them from the mid-90s in the Middle District of Florida, where in imposing the life sentence, the court did not impose the term of supervised release required by statute.
Okay, Mr. Labonte, thank you very much. You saved your time for rebuttal.
Thanks.
McNamara.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Linda McNamara for the United States. I think beyond that policy concern that Judge Jordan just brought up, there is a more fundamental concern, and that is if the addition of this term of supervised release in this situation increases the defendant's overall sentence, the district court is not authorized under the First Step Act to give the defendant any relief. The relief under the First Step Act must be as if sections 2 and 3 of the Fair Sentencing Act had been in effect. And if section 2 of the Fair Sentencing Act had been in effect at the time of this defendant's original offense, an 8-year term of supervised release would have been mandatory. So if adding that term of supervised release increases his punishment, the First Step Act doesn't authorize release here. Now, that's not a result that anyone here wants, I think, and I don't think that's a result that's compelled by law. Now, Denson does a lot of work for us here on many of the issues that were raised in the briefs. It establishes that a First Step Act proceeding falls under Section 3582C, that consequently Rule 43 applies and establishes that the district court need not conduct a hearing in the defendant's presence, and that in any event, a First Step Act sentence modification is not a critical stage requiring the defendant's presence to meet the requirements of due process.
Ms. McNamara, this is Judge Newsom. So I think you're right about the bit about not being a critical stage at which the defendant has to be present. But as to the first point you made, that Denson holds or observes or something like that, that 404 motions necessarily fall into 3582, I'm not sure. I mean, the court sort of seemed to talk about the two in the same breath, but I'm not really sure that there was anything there approaching a holding that 3582 is a necessary prerequisite or vehicle for the 404, right?
Well, I think I disagree with you on that, Judge Newsom. I think necessary to the court's holding there that Rule 43 applies is that this is a 3582C proceeding. And if you look at this court's precedents and interpretations of Denson, mostly they've all been unpublished opinions, but have all taken Denson to establish that a First Step Act sentence modification is a 3582C proceeding. But
so,
I mean—
So just explain to me just sort of, I guess, as a matter of first principles, why that is. I mean, 3582 gives the district court the authority to do one thing, to modify a term of imprisonment.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How then could a 404 is clearly broader than that in the sense that it authorizes a reduced sentence. So how is it that what I'll call the smaller 3582 can accommodate the larger 404, just as a matter of kind of physics? How can it do it?
Okay, well, in a case like this one, where all we have is a term of imprisonment, I think this fits very neatly under 3582C.
Fine. Now, I hear what you're saying, but I guess I'm saying as an abstract matter, you've got two statutes and you say that 3582 is the necessary first step, the necessary, sort of prerequisite to a 404. Why would it be the necessary step to a 404 in a reduction of a supervised release term, but not in a term of imprisonment. I mean, the words are what the words are, right?
Correct. But so it is a necessary part of the procedural vehicle when a term of imprisonment is what we're talking about modifying. And that is what we're talking about modifying here, right? He didn't have a term of supervised release. Now, if all he had was a term of supervised release, I don't think that 3582C is the vehicle. It can't be. All it talks about is modifying a term of imprisonment. But
so sometimes I mean, here, 404 is a standalone. Hold on one sec. So sometimes 404 is a standalone vehicle and sometimes it's not. I mean, that just doesn't seem
sense to me. Well, I think it does make sense because the purpose of 3582C was to limit the revisiting of terms of imprisonment. It is specific to terms of imprisonment. So, I mean, we can't just read that out by taking 404B separately. I mean, 3582C's purpose was to define when a term of imprisonment can be revisited. And that is when it's expressly permitted by statute. And here 404B is the statute that expressly permits it. Now,
let me ask you just one more question about this vehicle issue and then I'll relent. So if your position is that 3582 is a necessary prerequisite, necessary vehicle to a 404, and it says can modify a term of imprisonment. By what authority did the district court here add supervised release? 3582 does not give it authority to do that. It only gives it authority to modify a term of imprisonment. So by what authority, on your theory, are you still with me?
I'm sorry, I just lost that whole thing you said. Could you start over?
Okay, that's okay. Let me try again, I'm so sorry. So if on your theory, 3582 is a necessary vehicle, right? 3582.
Only when there's a term, only when you're talking about modifying a term of imprisonment.
Boy, I just don't think I understand that. I mean, like if 3582 is the vehicle through which a 404 is brought, I mean, here's the thing. You have two things going on here. One, we have to acknowledge that the district court added supervised release, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So 3582 doesn't give it the authority to do that. Because 3582, hold on, what? Please.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. 3582 only gives it the authority to modify a term of imprisonment, which doesn't include supervised release. Then the 404 only gives it authority to reduce a sentence. And at least on Mr. Labonte's theory, a reduction of the component of the supervised release or an increase in the component of supervised release isn't a reduction of anything.
Okay. 3582 allows the modification of imposed term of imprisonment as expressly permitted by statute. It doesn't itself define what remedy the court, what the result can be, okay? I have to disagree with you in saying that 3582C doesn't permit the addition of the term of supervised release here because 3582C refers to as expressly permitted by another statute. The court can modify an imposed term of imprisonment as expressly permitted by another statute. So let's say another statute said, court, you can go back in and you can get rid of a term of imprisonment and only and impose a new term of just supervised release. I think 3582C would still be involved, would still be the vehicle because you are modifying an imposed term of imprisonment. We look to the other statute for the extent of relief available. And that's exactly what the court did here. It looked to the First Step Act for the extent of relief available. And as expressly permitted by the First Step Act was a sentence of at least 10 years imprisonment, up to life imprisonment, plus a mandatory term of supervised release, 8-year supervised release. Now, it also has to be a sentence reduction under the First Step Act. So, but here, of course, we're talking about a life term of imprisonment without any possibility of release. So I think any term of imprisonment to a term of years plus supervised release is going to be a reduction in the sentence. So I think that the district court did exactly what it was supposed to do. It modified an imposed term of imprisonment, and it reduced the sentence as if Section 2 of the Fair Sentencing Act had been in effect.
Right, Ms. McNamara, on a more fundamental level, mm-hmm. Congress sometimes passes laws that are overlapping in nature, mm-hmm. right? They're not concentric circles, but they overlap to a degree. Why isn't Section 404 of the First Step Act self-executing? I mean, it says that a district court can impose a reduced sentence as if Sections 2 and 3 of the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010 were in effect at the time the offense was committed. Why isn't that an authorization from Congress to reduce a sentence if everything that's supposed to apply applies?
Well, I think it would be were it not for 3582C, which of course pre-exists Section 404B, that says a court cannot modify an imposed term of imprisonment except as expressly permitted by statute.
Right, but the problem is that Section 404 comes later. And right. So to the extent that there is a conflict, right, one of the general canons of construction is if there's an irreconcilable conflict, you take the latter over the former because it's the latest expression of legislative purpose and intent. So why did that apply here?
I guess I see no conflict. I think that 404B is that expressly permitted by statute is what 3582C anticipated would happen, is that maybe from time to time Congress would find a need to enact a statute to allow a court to modify an imposed term of imprisonment. And that's exactly what Congress did here. Now, I guess I'm not really sure that any of this makes a lot of difference to the result here. I do think that Denson presumes and as part of its holding, as necessary to its holding, determines that the 3582C1B is the procedural vehicle here. But I'm not sure that ultimately it does make any difference to what happened here.
Right. Let's turn to a secondary issue, depending on what we decide on the first major issue. But when a district court, and I'm putting on my district judge hat, so mm-hmm. when a district judge is trying to decide what term of supervised release to impose and what conditions to impose, the judge usually hears from the parties, especially if non-standard conditions are going to be considered, right?
Yes.
In a scenario where the judge imposes non-standard conditions of supervised release in a case just like this one, mm-hmm. are the parties entitled to be heard? I'm not talking about a de novo sentencing hearing, but are the parties entitled to be heard? In other words, the judge has to tell them, listen, I'm going to impose the 8-year term of supervised release, but I'm thinking, given Mr. Blank's history of imposing these 4 non-standard conditions, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. are the parties entitled to be heard on those?
I think that certainly the parties are entitled to be heard in some fashion. Whether that has to be beyond in writing, I'm not suggesting
otherwise, but I'm talking about the ability to tell the judge what you think about that possibility one way or another. I know we don't have that in Mr. Edwards' mm-hmm. case because the judge said that the standard conditions applied. Mm-hmm. But I can very easily imagine a scenario where a district judge says, I'm going beyond the standard conditions, or at least I'm considering doing that. Is there a place to have some sort of process for the parties in that sort of scenario?
Yes, Judge Jordan, I think that
Counsel
in that-
2-minute warning.
Thank you. I think that in that scenario the party should have an opportunity to respond probably in writing to make their arguments in writing as they did here, particularly as to something like that, which would be a contested issue. And if it's a contested issue, I think due process requires some ability to present the party's position. So I do think in the situation of special conditions, not the standard as we had here, but I do think that some ability to at least present the party's arguments, due process would require that. Yes, I do agree with that. Yes. But beyond that, I think, Denson tells us this is not a critical stage in the proceedings. Nothing about the addition of the supervised release term changes that. There was no need for any type of discretionary factual findings here. We were talking about a mandatory, statutorily required term of supervised release, and with the imposition of standard terms. He filed a motion in which he presented his argument as to whether that should be applied at all. And I think that's all the process that was due him in this situation.
Can I ask you one yeah. more question? I take it your point, and you heard in my questions to Mr. Labonte, that your point here is that, you know, in a very practical sense, of course, this is a reduction because, you know, life without release changed to anything except death would be a reduction. But there's no magic, I assume, in your position between sort of time in prison and supervised release. It's not that like one is categorically different or worse than the other. Like I think Mr. Labonte has a hypothetical in his brief where he says, what if the district court judge reduced the prison term by one day, but tacked on 50 years of supervised release or something? You wouldn't say that would be a reduction in the sentence, would you?
I think that's a tough argument. I mean, I think, you know, when you get into a gray area like that, there is room for argument about whether that is really a reduction in the sentence. But here, you know, as you say, I mean, this man is out now. He's on supervised release. He's not in prison anymore. It's clearly a sentence reduction. But, I can see how there would be gray areas where something is, something maybe is, something maybe isn't. And if it isn't, it's not authorized by the First Step Act, you know, which gets back to my original point. If he's saying this is not a sentence reduction, he can't get relief and he has to stay in prison for the rest of his life. And that just makes no sense. And that's not what's necessary here. I see my time has expired. I just want to make one small point, if I could, just to sum up. If the court determines that the court could have reduced Edwards' term of imprisonment without imposing a term of supervised release, I do think a remand for the district court to reconsider its ruling is necessary. The district court here did stress in its order the importance of supervised release, particularly for prisoners who've been incarcerated for a long time, as Edwards has here. And if the court had not been authorized to impose that term of supervised release, it may not have exercised its discretion to reduce his term as imprisonment at all, or it may have tried to fashion some other sentence to help him transition after, such as home confinement or something of that nature. So if the court could not impose that term of supervised release here, the court cannot lawfully just remove the term of supervised release and affirm the reduction in his sentence. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. McNamara. Mr. Labonte.
Thank you. I'd like to first address Ms. McNamara's last point that she made there. And I think that her argument is foreclosed because in the district court below, there was no dispute among the parties that the court should reduce Mr. Edwards' term of imprisonment to 262 months. And there was no opposition as to that. And the only issue that was litigated was whether the court had authority to impose a term of supervised release, and if so, what process was required. So I think that the government has waived the argument that if the court, it didn't condition its consent below as to the term of imprisonment on the district court imposing the term of supervised release, they were separated issues that were litigated there. And I also don't read the district court's order to say that if it could not impose a term of supervised release, it would not have reduced Mr. Edwards' sentence. So I just want to make that clarification as to Ms. McNamara's point there. And I also want to touch on the government's reliance on 3582C1B and the Denson case, because if this court is to hold that 404 is its own vehicle, I think that Denson is somewhat undermined for several reasons. If 3582C1B is the controlling statute here and 404 is the ancillary statute, by its plain language, C1B says the court can only touch the term of imprisonment and modify that. So the term of supervised release is outside of the court's authority to modify or reduce if 3582C1B is the controlling statute.
So Mr. Labonte, can I ask you a question? And I'm not asking you to divulge your litigation strategy, but I guess I was a little surprised in your supplemental briefing that you didn't make the argument that you just made. I mean, I thought what you might have said in response to our question about what's the vehicle, you would have said, well, 3582 is, and 404 is the ancillary. And if 3582 is the governing sort of vehicle standard, then the only thing the court could have done here is touch the term of imprisonment, and it had no authority to do anything with supervised release. But you didn't say that. You said that 404 is a standalone vehicle.
Well, I think that 404, and I think I've consistently maintained this position, authorizes the district court to reduce components previously imposed. So in a case where a term of supervision had previously been imposed, the court under 404 is within its authority to reduce that. But here, where supervised release was not a consideration and imposed by the district court, it does not provide the authority for the court to do so. But if this court is to hold that 3582C1B is the controlling statute here, the issue of supervised release is outside of the court's jurisdiction as it speaks only to a term of imprisonment, and then we're to read a reduced sentence in section 404 as relating to a term of imprisonment. And the Denson case also, I think if this court divulges from 3582C as the C1B as the controlling statute, here the district court considered matters that it did not consider at the initial sentencing. And that is the component of the term of supervised release. So Denson's holding that a hearing is not necessary because this is a proceeding under 3582, it would not stand if 404 is its own vehicle for which to do this, because Rule 43 does not preclude a motion brought under 404 from having a hearing. And additionally, the Denson case relies on the Brown case in terms of what the standard for having a hearing is. And I think here, Mr. Edwards, if the court was within its authority to impose a term of supervised release, which I submit it was not, a hearing was necessary because the court was undermined the sentence as a whole, and it was exercising its significant discretion. And I think that's what the court was doing here in modifying the defendant's sentence, perhaps on questions the court was not called upon to consider at the original resentencing. I see that I'm out of time. So unless there are any other questions, I submit that the district court was without authority to impose the term of supervised release as to Mr. Edwards, but if it was within its authority, in this case, a hearing was necessary because it added components that Mr. Edwards did not have notice of. Thank you.
Right. Thank you both very much. It was very helpful. Thank you.